This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
So, Gongxi Fa Zai. This is Chinese or Lunar New Year.
Yeah.
The moon is new, so it's just starting out on its venture for 28 days. Well, thank you, sir.
Thank you. It's purity.
We just had a calligraphy weekend, and of course the last character of the calligraphy here is moon. Yeah, it's a rather unusual looking moon. This whole writing is done, you know, in a rather cursive style and by the rather flamboyant person. And it was interesting. We had a tea here a couple of weeks ago, and two Chinese women attended the tea, and we were using this as the sort of focal point for the tea. And so afterwards, these women looked closely at the seal here, seals, and they were excited because that's Jackie Chan's seal. The famous actor, Chinese actor. So apparently he wrote this whole thing. because this placement of the seals would be done by the writer, not by the owner. The owner would have added somewhere else, but so he must have written this. Don't know for sure, and we have no idea how it could have ended up here at Jikoji. It's been hanging on the wall here for years, and no one has ever said anything about it, really.
Gosh.
So the characters, they're more legible if you look at these. Oh, it should stand over here.
Jiro, could you pull the curtain back a little more?
Yes.
We can't see from this angle.
So this character, this is wind, and this is this one, which is blow. This is not. This is move. This is heaven. It's kind of amusing. Heaven looks so small here, but it's basically originally this character. And then this character means a limit or edge. In this case, together with heaven, it means like the zenith, the highest point. And then moon, this is more typical way of doing moon, but this is more interesting, this way of doing it. And then his name here is, this is like to make or become or excellent, something like very positive sort of verbal word. And then this is dragon here. And this probably means right. It's very cursive, so it's hard to tell for sure. So anyway, we have the wind blows, or no matter how hard the wind blows, it does not move the moon high in the sky, high in heaven, something like that. And this is a very old phrase from the collection of stories and biography of, it's called The Transmission of the Lamp. That's a apparently the earliest collection of stories in the Chan tradition in China. Chan became Zen in Japan. And so this collection called The Transmission of the Lamp is very early. And it's not, it doesn't seem to be translated very fully yet into English. So I don't know how we can find, where we can find this particular phrase. However, this phrase is actually the first part of a two-phrase poem. The second part is over here. I don't know, they can't really see it, but so this also is seven characters. So it's just a match for that one. And this says, snow piles up, impossible or extremely difficult to break down. And this is a valley, depths or bottom, pine. You can tell it's a pine because it's green, right? So no matter how high the snow piles, it's impossible to break the pine tree in the bottom of the canyon. That's the idea. So these are a nice pair. So that's the kind of frame for the weekend, the wind and the snow, which is a good. Thank you.
You're welcome.
It's a good kind of subject for this winter time. So. I feel this, the Xing Xing Ming, which we chanted. You might look at it now, it's page 21. There are many sort of surprising or unexpected phrases here. For instance, the bottom of the first group, fifth line down. If you want to realize the truth, don't be for or against. And then 10 or more lines down. If you don't live the Tao, you fall into assertion or denial. Asserting that the world is real, you're blind to its deeper reality. Denying that the world is real, you're blind to the selflessness of all things. And of course, the next line is so delightful. The more you think about these matters, the farther you are from the truth. So you might as well just throw this thing out. So these things sound pretty extreme or just very difficult to how in the world do you practice this kind of thing? Well, recently I remembered this story I had heard a long time, I had read a long time ago. And so then I thought, well, I'll look it up online and see what the story is, because my memory is not that good. So I was surprised to find online that this story is quite well known in certain realms. It's the story of Sono, who was an elderly wise woman in rural Japan, maybe 200 or 300 years ago. When I read this story, she was a sort of sage-like elder in the Pure Land Buddhism tradition. In Pure Land Buddhism, the most well-known practice is reciting the name of Amida Buddha,
just many times, and that practice basically is what is needed. So it's seemingly rather simple and straightforward. But of course, the implication is that this appreciation or prayer or whatever you want to call it gradually sinks very deeply into your mind, and it's with you all the time, day and night, so to speak. So at any rate, this old sage named Sono was appreciated by many people, and people got to know that she was a special person. So people would come to visit her for some kind of ailment that they had, physical ailment, or they were suffering from the bad relationships with their family, or they had just psychological problems, or they were on a spiritual journey and they were frustrated. And when they came to her, well, for example, there was this one man, businessman, who came to see her and told her all his troubles. And what can I do? You know, everything is so horrible in my life. So she said, at every moment when you wake up and when you fall asleep and when something comes to your mind, or something happens, you know, there's an earthquake or somebody comes in the room or the dogs bark, anything happening, you just say, thank you for everything. I have no complaint whatsoever. So he was kind of surprised. That sounds very simple and straightforward. So he thanked her, and then he went on with his life. And it wasn't that simple for him after all. And so quite a while later, maybe 6 months or a year later, he came back to her and said, well, I appreciate your advice, but you know, when these terrible things happen, they're really awful, and I can't really be thankful for them. So what am I going to do? And she said, thank you for everything. I have no complaint. Then he somehow received that a little more deeply, and he appreciated that and went his way, and things seemed to change for him. So you can imagine with these various people who came to see Sono, they would have various reactions, and some people were able somehow to take it deeply to heart, and other people just thought, well, she's just another one of those crackpots. We have enough of those already. We don't need another one. So I've been thinking about this for the first time in a long time. And so I'm talking to myself as well as to you, because I haven't been practicing this in any conscious way. But if something happens and you say, thank you for everything, the one thing that happens in your mind is that you receive this happening more fully. Suppose you get a toothache, or you have a friend drop in. Either one of those things, thank you for everything. So when you're suffering from your toothache, you're certainly not consciously grateful for it and would like to have another one. But on the other hand, if you realize that This has really come to you, this toothache. And if you can really receive it, then you will do something about it, or you will take it a little bit more seriously, rather than saying, well, I'll wait to call the dentist for a month or something, because it's just not convenient. So the saying thank you to something before you think about it, and well, it's good or it's bad, I like it, I don't like it, I want more of it, or whatever. If you just say thank you in regard to that, your mind is sort of stifled in making a judgment about it. And so that you just fully receive it, you experience it, or you embrace it, so to speak, in a way that you hadn't done before. So it also enables you to have a sense of relaxation into this connection which you are having with this situation, or with this event, or this person, or even this, maybe you had some thoughts that came which were surprising, and you're thankful for them. Even if they are disturbing thoughts, you are recognizing them. You are saying, oh, I see you. I'm looking at you, and I'm taking you more deeply, and so that I can eventually respond in a deeper way. Also, by saying thank you to what has happened. Suppose that some dog runs up to you and starts barking frantically at you, and you say thank you for everything. it lessens a little bit this sense of I over against this event. There's more a sense of recognizing connection or oneness, of that this event is what is happening. It's not I and you or it. It's more the connection, connecting. There is connecting. So this event happens. Thank you for everything. This connection is more deeply sensed, because you're not immediately thinking about what am I going to do about this, or I've got to fix this, or this has got to stop, you know, this kind of thing, where I am going to do something in relation to whatever it is. So that's not your first thing. When you say thank you for everything, there's just this sort of recognition of this beingness, of this relationship you are having with this event or this person. So we find the sense of I that we have is not so fixed and not so separate from everything else. Whatever is happening, we are in relationship with it. And we are not just this individual item here over against that. But there's basically relationship happening. So when we are able to say thank you for everything, then we are also then, in a sense, more deeply open to it, because we haven't put up a whole bunch of judgments about it. And so then our response to this event can be a little deeper and perhaps a little more appreciative of the whole environment in which this is happening. This meaning the event and I together. Mm. I like to see this response that Sono gave to the people who came to visit her, not so much as a teaching. I mean, we're always wanting to have teachings. The problem with teachings is that the teaching person is here, and then that teaching person is telling you something which you are supposed to hear and then try to follow. May be helpful, but sometimes it's that teaching person is rather different from me, for instance, and it's kind of difficult to stretch into what that person is trying to teach, because they're teaching from their perspective and I'm receiving it from my perspective. So what I like to see teaching, the act of teaching, more as a reflection of the person's experience, the person's knowledge, and so on. A reflection rather than a teaching. So what Sono told everyone who came to her, of course people thought of it as a teaching, but it was very much a reflection of her experience and her aspiration. We don't know how faithfully she thanked everything, but that was what she felt really mattered. Mm. So this is a reflection of her sincerity, we could say. So I think it's good. That's one of my appreciations, actually, of Buddhist teachers in general, is that they tend to be sharing what they have experienced and what they find to be important, rather than just repeating some truth that is in the scriptures or in some place, and it's something that you just have to take on faith. Mm-hmm. So we can be very grateful that in the Buddhist tradition, there's much more a sense of reflection of one's life than just straight teaching. So I wanted to read a poem by Rumi, which is reflective of this kind of perspective. It's called The Guest House. This being human is a guest house, every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes of an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice. Meet them at the door, laughing, and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. So I think that's enough to trouble you with. So thank you. If you have some comments or question, please go ahead.
Yes. So you mentioned about the reflection. Being so tall, we know that we majorly do is meditation. silence and reflection. What do you think about debate? Yeah.
Well, it's fun.
Yeah. I mean, in some other practices, I learned that some monks just sit in their debate against each other about their thoughts about what the Buddha said. But in Soto, maybe I'm wrong. In Soto, like we focus on meditation, we focus on reflection on ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Not, is that true that we don't encourage people to debate? Like we tend to not care too much, or kind of just care the most about what ourselves, what myself, like what I think, instead of what other colleagues think.
Yeah, well, I think, of course, it depends on the teaching tradition, even within the Soto sect. But I think you're right that the focus is much more on individual sort of inquiry. And then you interact with the teacher, of course. And I'm sure that some, occasionally, obviously, some monks would chat among themselves, but that isn't stressed, certainly. And it isn't a practice, as far as I know, of debate like is very common in the Tibetan tradition.
Thanks.
And their debate always, when the brief images I've seen of Tibetan debate, they seem to enjoy doing it. Mm-hmm. They're not just angry at each other. So it I'm sure it's a beautiful practice in its own way, but it is very different, that's mm-hmm. for sure.
Excuse me. Could you next time repeat what the
first the question?
Said? Yeah. So yeah. I know what's going on.
Yeah, he was wondering about the problem of
debate
among how much we do that in the Soto tradition.
Yeah. Yeah, I learned that in Japan they said that like shikandate, like shikandate, like you just need to meditate, right?
Yeah,
curious about what you think about this. You just need to meditate?
Yeah, I don't. I think that's a bit overstated.
Oh, maybe I'm wrong. I need to learn more.
No, I mean, some people do say that, no question. But I think there are other practices for that many people do, which can be beneficial. You don't want to be stuck in. Just you can only do one thing.
Yeah, that's kind of what I am. What is kind of makes me worry about this practice. Like we only do meditation, we only want to, we kind of 100% rely on the reflection on ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we will miss the chance to learn from others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any other? Yes.
I have a question. I realize that in modern society, people are chasing goals. Like also in the US, like we are chasing for like houses, like academic or career achievements. However, in the Tao or in Buddhism, we focus on living in the present and just like letting go of our opinions. Like, how do you think a man can bring this kind of thing into modern lives? Despite like this collective like goal, kind of like materialistic goal, how to deal with this part?
How to deal with the materialistic
part of
push.
Society.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What was the question?
So how does like what we see in the Xing Xing Ming, how does it work when we have this push in our society for more material things,
yeah.
getting things and becoming famous or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, the this, for instance, like in not holding to fixed views, that kind of idea. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't have any ideas or any views. But the point is just not to cling to them as if that's the only answer. So that you're, even though you're living by such and such a practice, or like you think, you know, maybe you're a vegetarian and you shouldn't eat eggs, or maybe you want to be a breatharian and just breathe. You know, you have those ideas, and then sometimes a change happens in your body, and then you realize, or you're advised maybe, that you should eat something different, or eat less, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So you're just open to being flexible. Flexibility seems to be really valuable.
Mm-hmm.
and not the problem with, I mean, one of the ways to see our current culture is that we're just fixed on certain mm-hmm. values, and
mm-hmm.
and we can't get out of them.
Mm-hmm.
And for instance, like now, this whole country seems to be in this pathetic condition of supporting Israel and this slaughter of all of these Palestinians. I mean, how can you say thank you very much for everything when that kind of disaster is happening? That's a big question.
Mm. Thank you. Yeah.
But flexibility is very important.
Mm.
Yes.
I have a question. I just had, when you were speaking, and both moving and the other part piece reminded me of the expression, loss is enlightenment.
Loss is enlightenment? Mm-hmm. Can you say a little more?
Well, you're welcoming these disasters. You're welcoming all of these things that are disappointing or disappointing to your sense of yourself or your sense of your life or just your happy, what the things that made you happy. They're some aspect of them being lost.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when all of these disasters are visiting you, you're losing. And what is happening, and what is happening, you know, rather than welcoming them, thanking, you know, thank you,
mm-hmm.
you're sensing loss. And I think in a way that welcoming them is almost using the loss as enlightenment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It certainly pushes you.
I think it's kind of similar to thinking that when you have losses in your life, they are, you can welcome them. They can be sources of enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Yes.
So I have a question. When you meditate, sometimes you have to do it very deeply, your heart becomes very tender. And there's something that opens up. And very, very tender. And then, in our world sometimes, when you're in such a place, and then someone says something that really might hurt, and in a place where you're very tender, you open up in a way that you move your difficult barriers.
Mm.
Maybe you could
tell
your thoughts on how to deal with
that. How to deal with that? She's remarking that sometimes when you're meditating, then you really settle deeply, and then your heart opens up, and you're very vulnerable, basically. And then maybe after meditation, you meet somebody, and they say something that is very hurtful. How do you deal with that kind of situation?
Or just, is that me?
No.
Oh, okay, good. Good.
Yeah, I think I'm not the best one to respond. But in regard to what has been said here, I think the sort of message is that when this painful comment is being made that just strikes you, in that moment before you even react, you know, in a sense that this is a terrible comment or I am offended, you say thank you. And that is, you can only do that if you have already been sort of practicing it. When you notice something happening, if your mind is already saying thank you for everything to this happening, then your mind is training for that kind of response. And then by saying thank you, it may enable you to sense where this person is coming from, rather than just pushing this person away. This is a terrible person, or you're making such a stupid comment. Get out of here, you know. So that's the only thing I can suggest on the basis of what we've been thinking about this morning. Does someone else have a comment?
I was just curious how long you say thank you for. For example, with the toothache, like every time your tooth aches, you say thank you. But at which point do you make an assessment or like, you know, to say I'm going to make a change now?
Yeah. Yes, I think saying thank you is not saying I'm happy to get it. I'm just going to live with this. It isn't that at all. It's just recognizing that this is happening in a deep way. So thank you, meaning I receive it. I recognize that this is happening. Mm. And I may respond right away. Call the dentist right now. So it doesn't mean that I'm just going to live with this situation. Doesn't mean I'm going to let the person who insulted me or hurt me. It doesn't mean that I'm just going to leave it at that. But first I'll receive what has been said and receive that person who they are, and then respond in a way that's that can be, hopefully can be nourishing for this connection, even if it's a rough connection. So does someone else have a
comment? Michael does. Online.
Oh, Michael, yes. Thank you.
Thank you for the talk, Thoreau. It's good to hear it. Actually, I was responding. I always think that pain is like the keystone to spiritual progress. You know, it opens us up, you know, like the person who's always happy, if they don't know pain, how do they know they're happy? I think, you know, loss opens us to gain, you know? And the thank you very much can be quite difficult, but I think it induces self-reflection and the pain opens us up to the pain of the world, which has its own beauty, you know? But that was my comment. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Nice to see you.
Yeah, it's good to see you.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm wondering about the direction of the thanking. Is it to the person doing it, or it could be an object, or is it, I don't know, the universe, or what's the direction of that was being thanked?
Yeah, I was thinking about that. Even the word thank you has a you in it, which seems like a, you know, a specific object in English. In Japanese, you say domo arigato gozaimasu, which isn't doesn't say you, it just says thanks. So to me, it has more of a general sense of appreciation to the universe. And of course, with the understanding of the profound interdependence of all things, it sort of makes sense that this thanks is a very broad thanks. Yes.
I think my question is about later on in that piece we just read. Basically, you're saying you should not stick to, you should say no to. Basically, you should not get stuck in duality. So there is no good, no bad. And then also related to your teaching, which is we say thank you for everything that has happened. It's like, sort of give me a vibe of we accept whatever happens and be in the moment. But if that's the case, why would there still be wisdom? Like wisdom, if you want to pursue it, it is some kind of a goal.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like if you don't have good or bad, mm-hmm. why is wisdom worth pursuing? Why do you still want it?
Well, I don't, I think you probably don't bother with it anymore.
And that is all this wisdom?
And then that would be a different kind of wisdom, mm-hmm. where you lose the need to have a specific object or condition that you want to get or get to. Did you get the question?
I think so.
So do you want to say or ask a little more?
No, I mean, I guess I wonder, like in different religions, they always want you to do something.
Mm.
Yes.
To behave in a certain way. But Buddhism to me always feels like just be.
Mm-hmm.
But then you're a human being, you live for a really long time. If you just be, it's kind of boring. So what do you do?
Yeah, I think if you are really open to this environment, to your own nature, which is in fact completely connected to so many different things,
mm-hmm.
that you will easily be drawn into what either what feels like it needs to be done or what attracts you. And you don't really have to worry about what you should do or what you should know. With this sort of broad kind of openness of connection to the whole environment, which is what is making you your apparent self. Yes.
I think I kind of get your question even more so because, like, personally, I tend to be somebody who has goals and has to, you know, get there. And I feel like the environment we work and live in is also set up in such a way that everyone wants to pursue something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm just.
I can't hear you.
Louder. Okay. I was saying I understand her question and. It seems like we live in an environment that's set up where, you know, we always are trying to pursue something. And if you don't pursue that thing, then you kind of remain stagnant or maybe somebody else goes ahead. And there's always that kind of pushing you forward in some way or requirement to have to push yourself forward. So I kind of get where she's coming from. But the way I'm interpreting everything I've heard so far from the teaching, it sounds like it's not that we don't want to have goals. It's just that we don't want to have attachment to the outcome of whether those goals materialize or not. That doesn't mean we stop pursuing or, you know, trying to improve ourselves to work towards a goal. But it just means that you know, we do that without attachment to the outcome. That's how I interpret it. So I don't know if that helps. But, yeah.
Yeah.
I like that.
Thank you. Any other comment?
Yeah, I think thanks for sharing. And then I also want to share my thoughts. So I think for us growing up, we're trained very well, goal-oriented, and then to achieve step-by-step from school to career, right? But then what is lacking for me, I think personally, it's to achieve that zen-like peace of mind, and then it's the calmness. Just like what she said, detachment from the outcome, what other people's judgment, and then just be yourself and then pursue your goal. Mm. So I feel like learning more about the Zen, and so now just want to be, right? Realize the truth, don't be for or against. So make my mind it just more clear, and then also more awareness of myself, what makes me happy, and then it doesn't matter about the promotion or it doesn't matter. It's about what is the what other people say about me. So once you achieve this calmness, you can realize your potential. You feel like you can do much better than you would normally. You just take off the burden.
Mm-hmm.
So that's mm-hmm. what I appreciate. Mm-hmm. This is what really is just meditate, more care about myself, not outside world, all those variable, all those noise. So then I can be the best version of myself.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I should.
Thank you.
So for that, is it like Buddha teaches there's no true self, like there's no self, like the idea, like it doesn't even believe there is, I don't know, like a God, right? So like, how do you say, oh, I'm doing all of these things to do self-care when the concept of self itself is kind of an illusion? Like, how do you resolve that conflict? Because as an individual, obviously the most important thing is yourself, is your self-image. But if you really follow Buddhism teaching, you will realize that image itself is also kind of not as stable as we think.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, you know, like, so basically, how do you kind of resolve this kind of a, you know, conflict?
Yeah, I think you have to live. And in your life, we are always referring to ourselves. And then the Buddhist teaching is often that there is no self. But I think it's important not to stick to that idea either, that, you know, well, I was talking to myself the other day, but I don't really exist. That isn't really useful. And this sense of self that we have is you know, much more fluid than we realize. And we think that this sort of self, which is now, is the same one that was there when I was 10 or 20 years old. You know, we have all that kind of thing thanks to memory. But I think with meditative practice, just this sense of clinging to self just mm-hmm. becomes more, what would you say, just less precise and not something that you need to keep grasping onto. I've sometimes tried to use the words this rather than I. So like this is now talking to you. It's kind of helpful as a sort of experience, because if I say this is talking to you, it means this whole environment, not just this whatever I is here. someone was recently talking to this, so it's not just to this I, but to my world, my interconnections. So it's a much, you know, looser, broader
sense of self, but it's hard to maintain because English, we have I, which is very convenient. And we always capitalize it as well, you know, so it's curious. Yes.
On that, I just wanted to share a comment that like one of the analogies that kind of helped me to think about it is that we are just like cells, like if just like our body has billions of cells and each cell has a life where it is born, it creates its own food with the metabolism, it does it work for the other cells in the body, and then it dies. Just like that, we are cells in the human body that lives on the earth, and there's billions of us, and each of us lives, is born and dies. And so wouldn't it be funny if one of the cells in our body were like, you know, I am an individual, or I'm so sad that I'm dying, or look, I'm so happy. Then we as the body would say, why are you so self-obsessed? Like I'm self-dominating you in the body. So it's kind of just like that, I feel. And although each cell in our body is unique, has a unique function, is born, lives, and dies, if that cell was too much engaged in itself, it would not be a happy cell. But if that cell was aware of the whole human body that it is part of, that how it is connected to all the other cells that is making this organism work, it would be a happy cell. So just like that, if we see the whole human body that's living on the planet, and each of us, our cells, have a role to play in that. And it's not like as us as humans, as cells in the great human body, wisdom is our goal. But if we are wise enough to or aware to see the whole human body, then we take our role lightly. It's like, okay, yes, there's so many cells, and all of us have this role in the large human body. And then I think once we are aware of that, then the wisdom or the calmness or the lightness automatically comes.
Thank you. Well, I think we've thought and talked quite a bit, so I think it's time to digest. So let's go up to the dining area and have lunch.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.